Who remembers something from yesterday's class? To make the answer to the question even easier, what chapter was discussed yesterday? We'll create a frame of reference first. Or we could even,
Chapter 8.
Yes. And who remembers one of the gurus? What was learned?
Pigeon.
Pigeon. What in the world can we learn from a pigeon?
We learned from the pigeon in that case symbolized a person who is very foolish pigeon
itself. A foolish pigeon.
Overly attached to material affairs and becomes the due to that attachment for material enjoyment and for material relationship, then he attracts so much misery in his life.
Yes, this is a common theme in these chapters where the Avaduta Dattatreya, who is an incarnation of the Lord, is showing a particular type of path. Now it's known that this is Dattatreya who's speaking. It's also interesting that earlier on in the Bhagavatam, in the 9th canto, the same King Yadu, what was the test that he was given by his father? His youth, to trade his youth. And who was his father? Ayati. And what was his reply? Would he give his youth? No. Why? Puru gave his youth, and that was considered so exalted, but what was Yadu's reason for not giving his youth?
I need my senses to enjoy, and then later I can detach myself.
But it was more than just I want to enjoy now and later. That's true, but there's something a little more subtle.
The Krishna will appear in his dynasty, so he's going to propagate. And
that's another point. But what he was thinking was that renunciation, if done prematurely, if I just give up my youth, then the desire within me may not be extinguished. So better that I take it in a slow and more steady way, and I will enjoy now, and as a result of that enjoyment, I shall see that there is no enjoyment ultimately, that enjoyment means suffering. So then, when I actually have a depth of that realization, through going through life, through enjoying, as according to my destiny, then I will be able to be renounced. So this point here is the point where Maharaj Yadu will become renounced after meeting this Avaduta Brahmana. After this point, he will get renounced. Because so much of the teachings are about renunciation. Because this Dattatreya, he's not practicing Shuddha Bhakti, but rather he's practicing bhakti, or he's just practicing a different type of a path of renunciation. So Gyanera Asu Vairagyam, that Vairagyam comes naturally with bhakti, but yet we should know that detachment from matter is essential for bhakti, and it essentially springs naturally from bhakti. So many gurus were described, and I'm sure we remember them. On the examination, we're going to be asked to name how many? 24. All 24, and what did you learn from them? That will be on the examination. The examination called death, it will be on that one, that we will have to have. From the earth, the mountain, the tree, the air, the sky, the water, fire, the moon, from the sun, the foolish pigeon, that's the first 10. And then in chapter 8, Pingala, python. What did one learn from the python? Which was the Avadhuta Brahmana also taking that Agajara.
So it is coming naturally.
And the ocean. What did you learn from the ocean? Steady. Some more water comes in. Water. No water comes in. Anyway, don't get excited. From the moth, be careful. Don't go into the fire. From the bee, take a little bit from here and there. The deer, the fish, and Pingal. Now we will begin chapter 9, which will discuss the remaining gurus in this section out of his 24 gurus. So there were 17 so far, and there's a remaining 8, which will bring it to 24, or 24 or 25, is it? 18, 19, 20, 21, 24. So the saintly Brahmana said, everyone considers certain things within the material world to be dear to him. And because of attachment to such things, one eventually becomes miserable. So what's the stages of the mentality that are described here? But before that? Just in a simple way. Everyone considers certain things within the material world to be most dear to him. And because something is dear to you, then attachment comes. So what makes something dear to you? Something... But before you contemplate it, there's something you want from it. There's a desire to enjoy. So first there is a desire. And what mode of material nature?
Passion.
Is passion. So, and even if there are things that give us enjoyment that are in the mode of goodness, because we become attached to them, passion will come from goodness. Because the modes are always fighting each other for supremacy. And then, what happens next? Because of attachment, one eventually becomes miserable, because one cannot control the material world. One who understands this gives up material possessiveness. So the conclusion is, since one sees that my attachment to things and wanting to possess it for the purpose of my enjoyment is going to end in misery, therefore, to give up possessiveness and attachment, and then one can achieve unlimited happiness. So we will learn about the kurara, which is the hawk. Who knows how the kurari bird is famous too? Mahaprabhu spoke about the kurari bird. Where is that from?
Queens and Dwarka.
Yes, what chapter?
89.
90th, the final chapter. They speak about the kurari bird. And the kurari bird, interestingly enough, is also a symptom of attachment, in that is a symbol of attachment when the queens of Dwarka are speaking in a positive way, because the kurari bird is crying at night, making her call at night out of attachment for her husband. That's what the queens are thinking, just like us. So here, the kurari is an example of a group of large hawks who are unable to find any prey, attacked another weaker hawk who was holding some meat. At that time, being in danger of his life, the hawk gave up his meat and experienced actual happiness. So it is the giving up of material attachments that is the cause of not unhappiness, but happiness. Because usually People will think, if I give up my material things, I will be so unhappy. But just the opposite. When one is detached, one becomes happy. In family life, we'll read 3 and 4 here. The parents are always in anxiety about their home, their children, and reputation. So the Brahmana says, but I have nothing to do with these things. I have nothing to do with family life, nothing to do with parent, being a parent, home, children, reputation. I have nothing to do with these things, and I don't worry at all about any family. And I do not care about honor and dishonor. I enjoy only the life of the soul, and I can find love on the spiritual platform. Thus, I wander the earth like a child. In this world, two types of people are free from all anxiety and merged in great happiness. One is retarded, in other words, pagal, crazy, vimugdho. He's ignorant, he's crazy. And the fool, and the one who has approached the Supreme Lord. So this is a commonly known expression, that there are two kinds of people who are happy in this world, the fool and the great saint. One who has approached the Supreme Lord, who is beyond the three modes of material nature. So both of them live in another world. The fool lives in paradise, but it's a fool's paradise. And the sadhu, the exalted soul, he lives not in the material world, although he appears to live in the material world. He lives in the spiritual world. Because why? Why does he live in the spiritual world?
Because it's real.
Because it's real, but that's where we see him in this world. But why does he live in this? Why do we say he lives in the spiritual world? His consciousness is there. He doesn't have attachments to this world. He has attachments to that world, the world of Krishna, the land of Krishna. Now another one. So that was the hawk. Then, once, this is 5 through 10 about the girl and her bangles. Once a marriageable young girl, was alone in her house because her parents and relatives had gone that day to another place. At that time, a few men arrived at the house specifically desiring to marry her. She received them with all hospitality. The girl went to a private place and began to make preparations so that the unexpected male guest could eat. As she was beating the rice, the conch bracelets on her arms were colliding and making a loud noise. The young girl feared that the men would consider her family to be poor because their daughter was busily engaged in the menial task of husking the rice. And being very intelligent, the shy girl broke the shell bracelet from her arms, leaving just 2 on each wrist. Thereafter, so if there's 2 on each wrist, when you're doing something, activity, they're still going to make their noise. But she got rid of most of them. But the 2 bracelets on each wrist continued to collide and make noise. Now why didn't she break them all at once?
She must have been attached.
She must have been attached. Why don't we break all our material attachments at once? And because perhaps maybe it could be that we think, maybe I can get away with just this 2 bangles. But unfortunately, the noise continued. Therefore, she took 1 bracelet off of each arm. Interesting, she didn't break those. I guess she was going to put them back after. And with only 1 left on each wrist, there was no more noise. O subduer of the enemy, I travel throughout the surface of the earth, learning constantly about the nature of this world, and thus I personally witnessed the lesson of the young girl. When many people live together in one place, there will undoubtedly be quarreling, and just grab your guitar, etc. And even if only two people, so here's the two Bengals, if two people live together, there will be frivolous conversation and disagreement. Therefore, to avoid conflict, one should live alone, as we learned from the example of the bracelet of the young girl. Prabhupada once used this too, when he had servants, and they were talking, and Prabhupada brought out this example, that if you're alone, then there won't be all this talking, this, and it wasn't Krishna Katha, perhaps. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has given a nice example in this regard. This is from the purport. Because the young girl mentioned in the story had no husband, she had to fulfill her duties as a host by removing her bracelets so that each wrist held one bracelet only. In the same way, the process of Jnana Yoga, or spiritual advancement by philosophical speculation, demands that the speculating sages live alone without any other association. Why? Why? Because they'll just talk, and they have to keep their consciousness very deep. So this is so many of these instructions are actually on the jnana level, but they're helpful in devotional service. But they're basically sangha siddha bhakti items. They're not directly bhakti, but when they're used to help bhakti, they are considered also bhakti, but they are not inherently bhakti. They're not inherently potent with Krishna's energy, because living alone isn't inherently potent with Krishna's energy, like hearing, like chanting Krishna's names, because Krishna and Krishna's names are Vina Tvam Namanamano. But living alone isn't, Krishna is not necessarily there. So since the jnanis have dedicated their life to speculation, there will undoubtedly be endless argument and quarreling on technical points if many jnanis live together. Of course, with devotees, there's never any quarreling or arguing. Therefore, to keep a peaceful atmosphere, they must live alone. On the other hand, a king's daughter who has been fully married to an aristocratic prince fulfills her desire, her duties to her husband by dressing herself attractively and with innumerable ornaments and approaching him for love. Similarly, the goddess of devotion, Bhakti Devi, decorates herself with innumerable ornaments of the Vaishnavas who come together to relish the sweet sound of the holy name of the Lord. Because pure Vaishnavas do not intimately associate with non-devotees, it may be said that they reside alone. And thus, they also fulfill the purpose of this verse. So what's the purpose of the verse? The unnecessarily quarreling, and unnecessary gossiping, and unnecessary speaking. So better to live alone for that. But for the devotees, it is better to stay in the society of devotees. Tandera charana sevi bhakta sanevas janame janame hoy eyabilas. And speak Krishna Katha and serve. Because pure Vaishnavas do not intimately associate with non-devotees, it may be said that they reside alone, and thus they also fulfill the purpose of this verse. There cannot be any quarrel among pure devotees, pure Vaishnavas, because they are on the real platform of desirelessness, not wanting even salvation or mystic powers, what to speak of sense gratification. Because they are all devotees of Krishna, they may freely associate with one another for glorifying the Lord. What do you think about that? Jai, Haribaha, yes. Well, what do you think about it? How does that match your vision of reality? You're obviously living alone. Oh, right now. Yes, he said right now. Yes, that's what we're doing. But notice how there's only one person talking at a time. That's one of the keys. So what do you think about it? Good point. What else do you think about it? Yes?
We live alone.
Huh?
We are alone.
practically. How many showed up?
How many showed up where?
How many of all the Vaishnavas show up for this?
Well, they have their other services. But what else? What else? What do you think about it? It's saying this. There's no argument. There's no quarrel amongst pure Vaishnavas. So we can take the obvious point. Well, sometimes if there's quarreling, then we could say, oh, that means that everyone is not a pure Vaishnava. That one's too easy. Go deeper.
Sometimes the arguments are transcendental because they're both based on service.
Yes, I think it should be done this way. I think it should be done that way. But because they're based on service, therefore, okay, what does it mean that they're transcendental? Both, if they're arguments, what's the difference? We can say that they're transcendental, but what's the difference?
The motivation is seva, not.
Okay, so how does that affect the consciousness? Okay, now we're measuring this about against reality now. Okay, so how? So
cultivate the false ego.
Yes, yes, getting closer. Yes,
bring us to Krishna.
Yes, but what will be the difference when false ego is evoked and false ego is not evoked? When it's actually on the platform of service, on both parties, and everyone is trying to serve Krishna, what will be the practical difference?
No envy.
There won't be any envy. There won't be any pride. There will be respect. In other words, you won't take the disagreement like you have dared to disagree with me. I will curse you and may a brick fall on your head. And there's respect in there. There's respect. And why is there respect? Because this soul is sincerely trying to serve Krishna. This is the inspiration that Krishna is giving him. But there is certainly a loud disagreement. But it's kept on the point of, it's limited. The false ego doesn't get involved. So when our false egos become overly involved in this type of disagreement, this means that we are not on the right platform and there is not enough respect if we think that for the other souls, the other person who we're speaking to, it's actually quite an important point. Because we say that there's unity and diversity. So if it's all unity, that's not realistic, that everyone, there won't be any arguments or disagreements or anything like that. But that there shouldn't be any grudges. You know, 20 years later, you're saying, you told me this, and see, I was right, and I proved it to you. And I've been remembering it, just waiting to get even with you since then. So when the false ego becomes involved, that's the kind of thing that happens. So is that too much to ask from the Society of Devotees?
Sometimes.
That's a weasel answer. But the real question is it too much to ask from me? Because it's definitely too much to ask from the Society of Devotees. Because that's their business. The individual devotees have their own business of purifying their consciousness. But my business, my part in it is by accepting the point that it's not too much to ask from me when I'm dealing with devotees, that I should act on this level. And if I find that I'm unable to act on this level, then I should understand that I'm not, that I have to make some more advancement, I should be more humble. And therefore, if I understand that I should be more humble, then how, and I'm not as advanced as I would like to be or should be or could be, then why should I have complete faith in what my opinion then? If I see that I'm faulty in consciousness, why should I have complete faith in my opinion?
Yeah,
So therefore, it's just an opinion, a viewpoint, a view from one point. Because they may freely associate with one another for glorifying the Lord, for serving the Lord. That's the platform. In this connection, going to the end of the purport, in this connection, Srimadvacharya quotes the following. One should not under any circumstances live with those who are not devotees of the Lord. On the other hand, one should stay with many devotees because such association awards liberation. Muktida gives liberation. Sadjanai satu muktida. Now, moving onward to text 11. Having perfected the yoga sitting postures and conquered the breathing process, one should make the mind steady by detachment and regulated practice of yoga. So is this the same topic or it's moving to another topic? What was the last topic? What was the last topic?
Staying alone.
Huh?
Staying alone.
Staying alone? And yes, because if you're going to practice yoga seriously, as described in which book? Patanjali Yoga Sutras, and also one of the directly Vaishnava books. I'll give you Bhagavad Gita. What chapter? Sixth chapter. So one should, in a lonely place, practice yoga, not in the cities to make one's body healthy, but yoga to connect to the Lord should be practiced in a lonely place. Living alone, this is the practice of jnana yoga and the yoga element of it here. Perfecting the yogic sitting postures and conquer the breathing process past asana, yam yam, asana, and pranayama. One should make the mind steady by detachment and regulated practice of yoga. Thus, one should carefully fix the mind on the single goal of yoga practice. Purport. One should develop vairagya, or detachment, by observing that all material things are doomed. So that's very much jnana yoga. The Vaishnava mood is to see the material world as Krishna's. It's not, the emphasis isn't so much on how everything is breaks apart and crushed into dust of the material world. Rather, everything is seen in relationship with Krishna. This means that one should take to the regulated practice of yoga, which in this age means the process of chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. According to Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, the Avadhuta Brahman is recommending Bhakti Misra Astanga Yoga, or the Eightfold Mystic Yoga process performed as an offering to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because ultimately the mind is going to be fixed on Krishna. Yoginam api sarvesham madgitenam tarabana. Shadavan bhajate yomam. So now moving to the practice of yoga. The mind can be controlled it's really moving to a different topic and a different point that's going to be at the end of this section. It's going to be clear where this is really moving to, and this is a most wonderful point. The mind can be controlled, so practicing yoga. The mind can be controlled when it is fixed on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Having achieved a stable situation through yoga, the stability of the mind, the non-waveringness of the mind, the mind becomes free from polluted desires to execute material activities. Thus, as the mode of goodness increases in strength, one can completely give up the modes of passion and ignorance, and gradually one transcends even the material mode of goodness. When the mind is freed from the fuel of the modes of nature, the fire of material existence is extinguished. Then one achieves the transcendental platform of direct relationship with the object of his meditation, the Supreme Lord. So, 9:12. Excuse me. Yes. Here's the comment here from Vishnu. When the mind is controlled and restrained from the desire for performing fruitive activities, it becomes cleansed of the contamination of passion and ignorance through an increase in the mode of goodness. When the mind is no longer influenced by the mode of passion and ignorance, it becomes steady. And as a result of being situated in the mode of goodness, one becomes joyful. Comment by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. The three modes of material nature create conflict among one another. For that reason, those who are actually intelligent carefully control their mind. When one is freed from the influence of the mode of passion and ignorance, one achieves a life of auspiciousness. It is only possible to transcend the three modes of material nature when the mind is fully under control. What do you think about that? Is that encouraging? Discouraging? You can't transcend, it said. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, until the mind is completely under control. Why? It will loop. But if it means that, means if the mind has passion and ignorance, how will we control the mind? And if we can't control the mind, if the mind is jumping here and jumping there and jumping there and jumping there and thinking about this and I want to do that and lamenting things that happened 20 years ago and lamenting things that happened yesterday and thinking about I should have told him this, I wish I told her that, and tomorrow I'm going to do this. So with the mind uncontrolled, it sounds like japa this morning. This morning's japa session. When the mind is uncontrolled, we can't focus on Krishna. The mind will keep jumping to the material world. And then how can we transcend by definition? Unless the mind is situated firmly in transcendence, if it's not situated in transcendence, it will be situated in material thoughts. And by definition, we're not transcending if we're involved in matter, in the world of matter. So it's actually a very simple point, actually. Thus, because the goal is śradhavān bhajate yo mam, to fix the consciousness on Krishna, but we don't use the mechanical process of yoga to do it. We use first vaidhi bhakti, which supports the absorption in Krishna due to natural attachment. But this is the point that we're trying to achieve. And if the mind is uncontrolled and wandering all over the universe, we will not be able to achieve the point of transcendence. So therefore, the sarva vidhi nisheda cha, rest of the verse, etya eva kinkara. Or we're trying to always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna, and all the rules and regulations that we have, that we are following, are meant to facilitate the focusing of our consciousness on Krishna as a servant, as servants of Krishna. So therefore the rules that we follow, so that we don't addict our mind to the activities of the material world. So we don't do this, we don't do that, we don't do that, because we don't want the mind to be habituated to be in the enjoying spirit and playing with the material energy, bhunkte prakriti janeha, because then karanam guna sangas yas sada sad joni janmasu, we will not be able to fix our mind on Krishna, we will not transcend, we will remain always in the realm of matter. And the positive attraction for Krishna comes by the process of hearing and chanting and the association of devotees, etc., serving Krishna. Thus, this is 13, when one's consciousness is completely fixed on the absolute truth, so this is all about focus of consciousness, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one no longer sees duality or internal and external reality. Now here's the lesson that he's seen. The example is given of the arrow maker who was so absorbed in making a straight arrow that he did not even see or notice the king himself who was passing right next to him. So this is a powerful one, actually. This point, in one sense, is the essential point of all these teachings, is that we are meant to focus our consciousness, our mind on Krishna, become Krishna conscious. And ultimately, ideally, through complete, spontaneous, natural love for Krishna, and as a support for attaining that exalted platform, we follow so many rules and regulations, but their purpose is to bring us to that platform of spontaneous devotion. So, an example that's quite wonderful is given. There was an arrow maker. What is this an example of? Of someone who had focused his mind, as because the previous verses were about the practices of Astanga Yoga, and through Astanga Yoga focusing one's mind on the Supreme. So this example is the arrow maker who was so focused on making his arrow straight that the king, was with his elephants and they were playing gongs and playing trumpets and horns and drums, and there was such a loud tumult. But the arrow maker was so focused on his task of making his arrow straight that he didn't even notice the king and his retinue was passing by. So think about the arrow maker. How is it possible that he was so focused? On what? Making an arrow straight. Why was he so focused on it? If he wanted to make the arrow straight, there was a desire within him, and he must have learned that if I don't concentrate on what I'm doing, the result will be a crooked arrow, and I want to make the arrow straight. Therefore, I will focus my mind and become absorbed in what I am doing, and therefore, I will get the result that I want. So there is a lesson in this for us. But what makes the arrow maker so focused is he has to have the strong desire to make the arrow straight. Unless we have the strong desire, it doesn't make a difference. If we're traveling from point A to point B, if we're going to Delhi and we don't really have so much to do in Delhi, and something interesting we see on this side of the road and we stop and we look at that for a while and there's something interesting on that side of the road, and we won't get our purpose. But if you really have something important to do in a particular place and you want to achieve something and that desire is burning in your heart, then you will get there and not be distracted by left and right. A saintly person. So here it's a matter of focus, and focus is a matter of desire. 14. A saintly person should remain alone and constantly travel without any fixed residence. So who didn't have a fixed residence that was spoken of over here? Huh? But we're going to hear about this is the next one. He shouldn't have a fixed residence. Why shouldn't he have a fixed residence?
Someone doesn't get attached.
And why doesn't he want to get attached? Because he wants to get attached to the Supreme Lord. This is why he's a saintly person, a sadhu. This is what he wants. He doesn't have a fixed residence, and also, not only does he want to get attached, but he doesn't want to
be diverted.
But there's something I'm thinking of. What does when you have?
He doesn't want others to become attached to him.
Yeah, but that's not the one I'm thinking of. What it's got to do with depending. Because etansa staya parapmanistam, we'll hear this later by the Avanti Brahmana, that to be a saintly person means to depend on Krishna, and when you're living in one place and you see that you depend on so many other people, so many other things, and you forget all about Krishna, practically speaking. So this is the benefit of these type of activities. So living without a fixed residence isn't necessarily spiritual, because as we'll hear, like a snake doesn't have a fixed residence, but we've heard of spiritual snakes, but being a snake doesn't necessarily mean that you're spiritual. So being alert, he should remain secluded and should act in such a way that he's not recognized. Now here's the point that he wants to make here. He's not recognized or noticed by others. Moving without companions, he should not speak more than required. The lesson to be learned from the snake, this is Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur's comment from Uddhava Gita, is described as a snake wanders about alone out of fear of people, behaving in such a way that no one will notice it. An introspective sage should conduct his life in the same manner. So why should the introspective? Usually, we think of when we see a snake, we're afraid, and when we hear about snakes, what quality do we think of usually?
Envy.
So here it's taking a good quality of a snake, and what's the good quality? He's alone. And why is he alone? Because he's afraid of people. Does that mean that we should be afraid of people? And the answer is? Well, the point is that he was afraid of materialistic people because he doesn't want to become involved in materialistic thinking processes. So, in fact, the devotee should be afraid of becoming involved in materialistic thinking practices. When a person living in a temporary material body tries to construct a happy home, the result is fruitless and miserable. The snake, however, enters a home that has been built by others and prospers happily. So is this the process that we're recommending? Just going into someone's house? Excuse me, Prabhu, could you please leave now? Otherwise I will bite you with my fangs. But there's a lesson that we should pick up. The snake purport. The snake does not have the proclivity, tendency to build his own home, but rather lives in a suitable place constructed by other creatures. Thus he does not engage himself in the labor of home building. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur points out that although materialistic persons take unlimited pains to invent and mass-produce electricity, automobiles, airplanes, etc., ultimately these things are meant for the convenience of the Vaishnavas. Haribol. But perhaps they mean the real Vaishnavas, not like me. For the Vaishnavas who are preaching Krishna consciousness, in other words, everything is meant for the service of Krishna. The karmis will always go to such trouble, and the devotees will always offer such laborious productions to the Supreme Personality of Godhead by engaging them in his loving service. So utility is the principle. But before we jump onto the fast-moving train of utility as the principle. We should make sure that we have the fare, which is
purity
being the force. Because otherwise, we will end up using the things meant for Krishna for our own selfish pleasures, and we will get ourselves into trouble, and we will be cheating and hypocrites. The devotees being concerned, so it's actually such a heavy point, because using it for Krishna means using it all for Krishna, and not taking 4%, 6%, 12% cut for me. And we take what we need to live, to survive, and different people may need different things, but the mood, the consciousness, should be that it's for Krishna. Not 98% even. This is if we want to be like the arrow maker, who is so focused on what we want that that our arrow will be straight. If one engages such things with the desire to enjoy them, one falls from the platform of pure devotional service. So much sincerity is actually required. Now, the point continues. So the person, there is a continuity of points here of focusing on Krishna. And all the gurus really are teaching ultimately either by their positive or negative injunctions, how to go about life so that we can actually achieve what we really want, which is to focus on Krishna. So the arrow maker really brought it clear, and the snake is something that is important to achieve what the arrow maker had, which was the intensity of desire to make his arrow straight. In this case, what we're talking about is the focus, the full focus of the consciousness on Krishna. So, how to do that? The Lord of the universe, this is 16, Narayan, is the worshipable God of all living entities. So this is the principle. How are we going to focus our consciousness on Krishna? So this philosophy will help us do that. He's the worshipable God of all living entities. And since we are one of the many living entities in the category of all living entities, we are meant to focus our mind on Krishna too. And without extraneous assistance, nothing external to him, the Lord creates the universe by his own potency. And at the time of annihilation, the Lord destroys the universe through his personal expansion of time and withdraws all the cosmos, including all the conditioned living entities within himself. Thus, his unlimited self is the shelter and reservoir, the source of all potencies. So this is the definition of God, of the Supreme Lord, of the Supreme Absolute Truth. And how vast and unlimited are his potencies. And therefore, when Brahma saw this little boy wandering around the fields of Braja, the cowherd boy with a stick and a flute and a buffalo horn and a peacock feather in his head and his face painted with minerals and some food, yogurt and things, fruit mixed in his left hand. Krishna used to hold, he would hold. Did you ever see on an Indian bus? You ever been on an Indian bus where they're holding the money in their fingers? They have different, in between their fingers, they have different kinds of bills. So Krishna, that's where they got it from. Because Krishna, when he would hold his food, he would hold like some pickle in this finger, and he'd hold something in this finger and something else in this finger. Did you know that? That's where they got it from?
Where did you get that from?
Where did I get that from? This? Or what?
What you just described.
From the bus. From the bus I have learned, driver, I have learned many things.
From what Krishna is holding.
Huh?
I've only read Krishna holds this.
Godly.
But you have not read. You have not read all the commentaries.
Yeah. I've read none of the commentaries.
That probably, that's where I've got it. So Krishna would hold that. And Brahma, how is this boy? Because look at what God is. He's the absolute truth. All the potencies are being held within him and they come out external to him then. The subtle pradhan, the basis of all cosmic manifestation. What does pradhan mean in Sanskrit? Huh? First, the primal, the first. It's conserved within the Lord and in this way is none different from him. In the aftermath of annihilation, the Lord stands alone. So there's nothing external to him. Now, if we actually accept this and realize that everything we see in existence is none different from him, then how could we not see him everywhere? So, according to the purport here, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that this verse refers to Karanadaksha Vishnu or Mahavishnu lying on the causal ocean. When the Supreme, and now it's going to get to where he's gotten, how he's reminded of these things. And this, by the way, is brilliant consciousness to be able to look in the world and see Krishna so clearly in everything that one sees. And see everything as being useful in Krishna's service, and seeing the philosophy of Krishna consciousness being exhibited in all the different creations of the Lord. But the jnani type of mentality will see philosophy more, and the full devotional mentality we'll see, everything will directly remind him of Krishna. So he's still in, he has some jnani type of mentality, the avadhuta. So, when the Supreme Personality of Godhead displays his own potency in the form of time and guides his material potencies, such as the mode of goodness, into a neutral condition of equilibrium, he remains as the supreme controller of the neutral state called pradhan, as well as of the living entities. He's also the supreme worshipable object for all beings, including the liberated souls, demigods, and ordinary conditioned souls. The Lord is eternally free from any material designation, and he constitutes the totality of spiritual bliss. This is Krishna, which one experiences by seeing the Lord's spiritual form. So the Lord thus exhibits the fullest meaning of the word liberation. He's free, completely free from all material, but he's not impersonal. He's none different from everything that we see, everything that we experience. He is not separate. He is transcendental and immanent. He is beyond and also everywhere, close. He is far and near at the same time. O subduer of the enemies, at the time of creation, the personality of Godhead. So that was the maintenance. No, here's creation and annihilation. Was already manifest, was already in the previous verse mentioned. O subdue of the enemies, at the time of creation, the personality of Godhead expands his own transcendental potency in the form of time. So all this is coming from this little boy who's herding the cows. It's quite astounding. How do we know it's true? that little boy, all this is coming from him. Well, we could test him and see, like Brahma did. He ended up being quite dumb. But we don't have the potency that Brahma has. How else do we know it's true?
Shastra Praman.
Shastra Praman. Shastriya. Shraddha. How else? Huh?
So with her own eyes. Yashoda saw it with her own eyes in his altar.
In universal form, two times?
All the gopas saw it.
Yeah. But how do we know it's true? Did you ever ask that question? How do you know it's true?
There's no descriptions as everything exists within
him. Huh?
The whole description teaches how to see it.
How do we know it's true? We've seen. That's wonderful vision. If just by seeing you can know. How do you know it's true? So your faith. Faith in Prabhupada.
Well,
all correct good
answers. The Big Bang Theory is so stupid, we might just say that accept it.
This makes more sense than that. The Big Bang and the it all just happened by chance. Very unlikely. Very unlikely it all happened by chance. Yes? Quite unlikely?
Impossible.
Huh? Impossible.
What do you mean by the word no?
By no? Oh.
You say
realize the depth of your realization.
We don't.
Huh?
Well, we don't know.
Say, put it in the first person singular.
I don't know.
Okay.
Sure.
So when Prabhupada is asked this question, his answer, when you follow it back, someone will say, well, we accept Shastra. And then someone, a doubting person, or one from a different culture, who has different, they say, well, why should I accept your books, your Shastra? So what was Prabhupada's ultimate answer? Of course, we chant and we experience. We chant Krishna's names, and there is a reply. So that increases our faith. But ultimately, what was Prabhupada's answer to this question if someone is being really skeptical? Does anyone know? Huh?
He said, even if it's not true, still I want to follow.
That wasn't, I never heard him say that one.
Really? I heard very much you say that.
Yeah, where?
I don't know where.
Oh, okay.
I also heard that reporter was asking Prabhupada, you talk like that, but what in the end if there's no Krishna?
Yeah, why the Prabhupada?
So, even if there's no Krishna, it's so nice what I'm doing. I'm chanting, I'm dancing, I'm singing, I'm taking prasadam.
But he wasn't proving it then.
No.
But yeah, but it's an interesting answer, an interesting point.
And I think it goes further, not just like that. And then when we die, we will go to Krishna.
That's what Prabhupada said after.
Yeah, and then if there is no God,
yeah,
then no problem, we just die. But for you, who don't believe in God and who live a sinful life, if there is no God, no problem. But if there is a God,
yeah,
and the law of karma.
Then some problem is just now coming.
The gambling argument for Blaise Pascal is the argument for Blaise Pascal.
Yeah.
Because no one can. He must be reading Prabhupada's books, Pascal. Obviously.
No one can what?
No one can say that there isn't a God authoritatively. I mean, because there might be some place that you haven't looked. There's no inductive proof like that. But anyway, Prabhupada's ultimate argument for these things was a few things. One was there are so many great acharyas, Rupa Goswami, Raghunath Das Goswami. They were wealthy. They had everything in society. They had all material facilities, and they gave up everything for Krishna. So do you think they were fools? Do you think they gave up? Who gives up something willingly, happily, irrevocably, irrevocably, gives up something more for something less? No one does that. You give up something less for something more. So the argument that I heard him give, or not directly, but through the through hearing lectures and things like that, this is the one, he ultimate one, that we have faith in the acharyas. Faith is required, but it's, you know, that's what he said. And a different form of that same point was that there, you know, in the Western cultures, they don't, or the Judeo-Christian Islamic, the people of the book, as they call them, they don't have any faith in the deity. So Prabhupada would say that there are millions of people who go to the deity and pray and are feeling satisfied. Do you think they're all fools? That they're just imagining that they're getting something from it. Everyone's a fool but you. So the great acharyas, their path is the path that we follow. Look at the life of Srila Rupa Goswami of Sanatana Goswami, of Raghunath Das Goswami, of Srila Jiva Goswami. Jiva Goswami was such a powerful scholar. Such a powerful scholar. Look at his conclusion. And look at the realms that they're writing of. Do you think they were fools writing fiction?
The same argument is given by Rukmini Devi also to Krishna. Actually, one argument is telling the great kings, they give up and come to you.
They give up all these things and they come to you. Do you think they are fools? Do you think they're not getting anything? There's a what do you call it? Loka Praman, that Raghunath Das Goswami was in Radhakund, just crying and crying and crying and crying and crying. And so thin. So someone came over to him and said, "You're the son of such a wealthy person. If you're so hungry and you're crying, why don't you just go home?" "Just go home then, you'll get food." And he said, "No, thank you, I'm quite satisfied just sitting on the banks of Radhakund, crying and crying and crying." So, 19. O subduer of the enemies, at the time of creation, the personality of Godhead expands his own transcendental potency in the form of time, and agitating his material energy, Maya, composed of the three modes of material nature, he creates the Mahatattva. This is the term sutra. Is used in this as the Mahatattva in the next in text 20. Sutre Manigana Iva. That the everything is resting on Krishna. He is the sutra. According to great sages, that which is the basis of the three modes of material nature and which manifests the variegated universes is called the sutra or Mahatattva. Indeed, this universe is resting within that Mahatattva, and due to its potency, the living entity undergoes material existence. So this is trying to show us, he wants us to see, that this material existence, everything that we see, there is nothing that we see that is separate from Krishna. So therefore, we can focus our mind on Krishna. We can, just by looking at this world. And then he's giving the example that he's seen. And it's a wonderful example. And it's interesting how he's seen the whole manifestation of Karanadakshay Vishnu and the potencies, the self-sufficient potencies of this unlimited personality of Godhead. He's remembering that. He's seen that. The whole concept of the expanding of the material existence from Lord Karnadakshay Vishnu comes from him seeing a humble spider. So that is quite extraordinary vision, philosophical and wonderful vision. Just as from within himself the spider expands thread through his mouth and plays with it for some time and eventually swallows it, similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead expands its personal potency from within himself. So Brahma actually saw Krishna doing this, expanding universes from his little boy body in Narayan forms, and covered each of the infinite universes, expanding, and all living entities were worshipping the Lord, who was covered with tulsi all over. He saw all these different forms expanding from little Krishna. And therefore he was convinced, yes, I've done the wrong thing. I've played with fire. I've gone beyond my capacity. I have challenged he whom I shouldn't have challenged. My potency is too insignificant. So he's comparing, so here the Dattatreya is comparing this unlimited Lord to a spider. Thus the Lord displays the network of cosmic manifestations, utilizes it according to his purpose, and eventually withdraws it completely within himself. Now, the point being, it's now expanding on this point of somehow or another seeing Krishna, because seeing Krishna, thinking of Krishna, and focusing the consciousness on Krishna is so potent, and he's giving instructions how to do this by keeping your eyes open through all these different gurus. They will teach you. If your consciousness is open to Krishna, you will find so many gurus to teach you. Even a humble spider can open up the entirety of the nature of Karanadakshay Vishnu to your consciousness. Because, and then you'll think of Krishna, because the point is to think about Krishna. Because thinking of Krishna is so powerful, it's so purifying, it acts in two different ways. It removes contamination and increases one's relationship with Krishna. So then, a verse similar to verses in the 7th canto, chapter 1. If out of love, so moving, it's in one sense, there's a thread that we're moving along here. But the example is going to change. But it's the same thread of focusing the consciousness on Krishna, being detached from so many material things. Don't get attached to your home. Don't be attached to this. Don't be attached to the pigeon-like existence. Be like the arrow maker. So many things we shouldn't do, and really moving quickly forward on what we really should do. This full concentration on Krishna. So if out of love, hate, or fear even, an embodied soul fixes his mind with intelligence and complete concentration on a particular bodily form, he will certainly attain the form that he is meditating upon. Purport. So this is, these verses, I'll read the whole section and then go to the verses in the 7th canto. Purport first. From this verse, it is not hard to understand that if one constantly meditates upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one will achieve a spiritual body just like that of the Lord. The word dia, with intelligence, indicates complete intellectual conviction in a particular understanding. And similarly, the word shakalam indicates one-pointed attention of the mind. With such complete absorption of consciousness, surely one will attain in his next life a form exactly like that upon which one was meditating. This is another example learned from the insect kingdom as explained in the following verse. So this is what we are trying to ultimately achieve. Like like Uddhav was telling the Brata Gopis that you should philosophically see me everywhere and everything. See Krishna everywhere. He was telling the Gopis that, which is a way of seeing Krishna that begins with the intelligence. And through the intelligence and the workings of the intelligence, one can ultimately and actually come to the point of seeing the Lord. But the Braja Gopikas, and even when Krishna spoke in this way, they replied differently in a sarcastic way. But the point being that the Gopis said, on a different level, they were on a different level, on a different type of a path. Their reply is, you're teaching us out of your kindness, you're giving us the charity of telling us how we can remember Krishna, but that's not our problem. Our problem is just the opposite, that we can't forget Krishna, and he's not with us. We're only thinking about him and always thinking about him. This is the path that Mahaprabhu actually taught. Not that these things aren't useful, but this total absorption through love and devotion and bhakti is the path that Srila Prabhupada gave us. Through chanting Krishna's names, through the process of cultivating bhakti or love for Krishna, these things are useful. And Prabhupada often would point to things of this world and give examples to show how they illustrate Krishna consciousness. But ultimately the point is if our relationship, if it is love-based, then it is powerful. Then it's tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusha para. Then it is powerful. If it is bhakti, if it's powerful bhakti, then it will push everything else aside. So the example given of the meditation on Krishna that will bring us to the spiritual world is given in the next verse. Once a wasp forced a weaker insect to enter his hive and kept him trapped there. In great fear, the weak insect constantly meditated upon his captor, and without giving up his body, he gradually achieved the same state of existence as the wasp. Thus one achieves a state of existence according to one's constant concentration. So that is so heavy if you think about it. It's so consequential that one achieves a state of existence according to one's what? What one is thinking about. So that means it's incumbent upon us to become very Krishna conscious. There are consequential results in the things that we cultivate within our mind. From 7 canto, first verse, 27 through 29, Narada Muni continued, by devotional service, one cannot achieve such intense absorption in thought of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as one can through enmity towards him. That is my opinion. Such an interesting verse. What does he mean by that? But anyway, that's not the subject of this class. But what he means is by ordinary devotional service, where you're just performing a devotional service without intensity, just because you're supposed to do it, where there's no true intensity in the consciousness, no affection, no emotion. He's not talking about devotional service like the residents of Vrindavan perform. But he's saying that when your concentration will be so much more intense on Krishna that even if you have enmity towards him, then sort of lukewarm devotional service, doing things just because you have to do them. Because the point is this concentration, on Krishna. Deep concentration is so powerful. So then two more verses, which are very similar to this verse. A grass worm confined in a hole of a wall by a bee always thinks of the bee in fear and enmity, and later becomes a bee simply because of such remembrance. Similarly, if the conditioned soul somehow or another think of Krishna, who is Satchitananda Vigraha, they will become free from their sins, whether thinking of him as their worshipable Lord or as an enemy. Because of constantly thinking of him, they will regain their spiritual bodies. So there's some very powerful and important instructions here that one has to become involved, personally involved in Krishna consciousness. O King, from all these spiritual masters, I have acquired great wisdom. So now he's on to his last one about the body. This is, I think, it's number 24. Yes. Now please listen as I explain what I learned from my own body. The material body is also my spiritual master because it... So no one can say that one doesn't... you might not see spiders and wasps and snakes all day long, but at least we can say we see our body. He stays with us continuously, teaching us continuously. The body is also my spiritual master because it teaches me detachment, being subject to creation and destruction. It always comes to a painful end. Thus, although using my body to acquire knowledge, I always remember that it will ultimately be consumed by others, and remaining detached, I move about this world. Now, I'm going to do something very extraordinary right now before reading the verse. I shall read the beginning of the purport. One might argue, this is a good argument, someone's very clever who argues in this way. So he's saying, my body is my guru, he's teaching me so many things. Amongst all the gurus mentioned thus far, the material body is certainly the best, since it awards one the detachment and fine intelligence that enables one to engage in devotional service of the Lord. Thus, we should serve the body. We should serve our guru. It's the best guru, so we should give our body the most service. Good point, huh? One may argue that. Thus, we should serve the body, although it's temporary, with great attachment, or risk the offense of ungratefulness. How can detachment from the body be recommended when the body is endowed with so many wonderful qualities and is teaching us so many things? So rather than being detached from the body because it's our great teacher, we should become extremely attached to the body and extremely deal with it with a serving mood. Now that philosophy would be very popular. But the next verse is spoken by the Avadhuta Brahmana to dispel that. I thought that was quite funny myself. Yeah. A man attached to the body accumulates money with great struggle to expand and protect the position of his wife, children, property, domestic animals, servants, home, relatives, friends, and so on. He does all of this for the gratification of his own body. As a tree before dying produces the seed of a future tree, the dying body manifests the seed of one's next material body in the form of one's accumulated karma. Thus assuring the continuation of material existence, the material body sinks down and dies. A man who has many wives, more about this situation, about the material body and how we shouldn't serve it, because it's going to die. and our attachment to it will cause us, and our service to us will entangle us so much in the law of karma and give us so much trouble. A man who is attached to many wives is constantly harassed by them. He's responsible for their maintenance, and thus all the ladies constantly pull him in different directions, each struggling for her self-interest. Similarly, the material senses harass the conditioned soul, pulling him in many different directions at once. On one side, the tongue is pulling him to arrange tasty food. Then thirst drags him to get a suitable drink. I once saw an advertisement in Perth for some kind of a soft drink that said, "Obey your thirst." Simultaneously, the sex organs clamor for satisfaction, and the sense of touch demands soft, sensuous objects. The belly harasses him until it's filled. The ears demand to hear pleasing sounds. The sense of smell hankers for pleasant aromas, and the fickle eyes clamor for pleasing sights. Thus the senses, the organs, and limbs, all desiring satisfaction, pull the living entity in many directions. So purport Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions that after understanding this verse, one should merely offer without attachment the bare necessities to the guru of one's body. One should keep one's body fit and working in the simplest possible way, and that is the sum and substance of service to this so-called guru. If one desires to faithfully serve the body, one should consider that the body pulls the consciousness of the conditioned soul in many ways at once, and thus for the servant of the body, there is no possibility of understanding God or even becoming peaceful. Onward. The Supreme Personality of God, at expanding His own potency of Maya Shakti, created innumerable species of life to house the conditioned soul. So this karma that we accumulate in this life is going to place us in one of the millions and millions of kinds of bodies, innumerable kinds of bodies. By creating the forms of trees, reptiles, animals, birds, snakes, and so on, the Lord was not satisfied within His heart, and then He created human life, which offers the conditioned soul sufficient intelligence to perceive the absolute truth and become pleased. After many, many births, so this is the proper use of the body, using it in human life to attain spiritual knowledge. After many, many births and deaths, one achieves the rare human form of life, which although temporary, affords one the opportunity to attain the highest perfection. We should try for that. Thus a sober human being, not intoxicated but sober, should quickly endeavor for the ultimate perfection of life as long as his body, which is always subject to death, has not fallen down and died. After all, sense gratification is available even in the most abominable species of life, whereas Krishna consciousness is possible for only a human being. What three verses come to my mind in the Bhagavatam that make this point, similar point? Anyone can think of one?
Nayandeham.
Yes, Nayandeham. What canto? Fifth canto. Who's speaking? Rishabdev. First? Another one? The ones I was thinking were Tasyaiva Hetu, Prayateta Kovido, Narada Muni, which says the same thing, basically, that so many sense gratification comes, just like misery comes, unasked for. Life is meant for something other than that. And Sukham Mandirya Daityam, spoken by Prahlad to his school friends. Same point, almost exactly the same points. This is the basic, I would say, the basic preaching of the Krishna consciousness movement. Use your human life responsibly. Get that which is manusha, which is durlabh, manusha janma. Life is... human life is rare, get something rare. Don't attempt to gain that which is available even in animal life. So now, moving to the conclusion. Having learned from my spiritual masters, he's finished his instructions to King Yadu. I remain situated in realization of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And fully renounced and enlightened by realized spiritual knowledge, I wander the earth without attachment or false ego. Although the absolute truth is one without a second, the sages have described him in many different ways. Therefore, one may not be able to acquire very firm or complete knowledge from one spiritual master. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur concludes there can be many, he says the conclusion is that there can be many Shiksha Gurus who strengthen one's knowledge. Jiva Goswami has a good point, an important point in this. One's worshipable spiritual master will instruct one in many departments of knowledge by giving lessons gleaned from ordinary objects. As recommended by the Brahmana Avaduta, one can strengthen the teachings received from one's acharya and avoid transgressing his order by observing ordinary things in nature. One should not mechanically receive the teachings of one's guru. The disciple should be thoughtful and with his own intelligence realize in practice what he has heard from his spiritual master by observing the world around him. In this sense, one may accept many gurus, though not those who preach against the knowledge received from the bona fide spiritual master. Comment by Jiva Goswami. Where did I get it from? Huh? From the purport. Okay. Not very esoteric. From the purport. Who would have expected that? Wonderful comment, too. From the purport. Yes, yes. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, having thus spoken to King Yadu, the wise Brahmana accepted obeisances and worship from the king and felt pleased within himself. Then bidding farewell, he left exactly as he had come. This was Dattatreya. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says the meaning of that he had left exactly as he had come meant by his own sweet will. He's not controlled by anything. And the final verse, O Uddhav, hearing the words of the Avaduta, the saintly King Yadu, who is the forefather of our own ancestors, became free from all material attachment, and thus his mind was evenly fixed on the spiritual platform. Okay. Let's end. It's a quarter after 12, and I've been given the task, not the test, the delightful task of finishing the 10th chapter in the next class. And the 10th chapter is question at some time, but not now, because there's a lot to cover in the next class, a whole chapter. And I'll tell it to you in a very concise and brief form. At the very beginning, and that will help us go through it in a meaningful way. Okay.